said go. Yes.
We said go. We're going.
Welp.
Welp.
That's
welp. Yeah.
Yeah. That, welp.
What is it? I don't even know what today is. Welp. I just know it's hot. Welcome to the Hope This Helps it's, hot cast.
This is the hottest episode I think we'll ever record this year.
Or no, in
that's
May.
Really a lie. It's only the beginning of the summer. But right. this is the hottest, soggiest, humidest episode I think
in
we
May.
Are going to be recording thus far.
Yes. It is,
is it May?
Yes, it's May.
But it is briefly May for a few more days.
I know. It's just for a couple more days, and it is the hottest day so far, and I am sweating bullets.
I don't have air conditioning in this house. I don't have air conditioning in this computer room. I have the fans off so they don't get picked up on the mic.
Same.
It's not feeling great. This is
when I'm now hoping to be back in the office. I'm like, I wish I was in my office where it's cold.
I really underappreciate HVAC and air conditioning in an office.
You almost just said I miss, and then you're like, wait, no, I don't know if I miss, but I underappreciate.
I will stop short of saying I miss the office, but I miss several aspects of the office for sure.
Like coffee at 2 p.m.
The consistent 2 p.m. coffee, although I could really make my own coffee.
It's not the same though. It's not the same.
There's coffee you make and there's coffee that other people make for you. And there is a major difference in the taste every single time.
And there's something about going with other people for coffee.
That too. That is, of course, the social aspect that you just can't really duplicate in a video call unless everyone gets on their phones in Zoom and walks to Dunkin' Donuts, which kind of doesn't work because of social distancing and network capabilities and people's ability to synchronize anything.
Like I would still really
trying to do a live performance.
Yeah, like right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right about that. I mean, I am mostly ready, except for the fact that I did almost nothing to prepare, and I apologize for that. I do feel really guilty, other than my brain is still stuck in the Smoky Mountains, where...
To be fair, I don't prepare much either. I just kind of...
You just throw amazing things into a document, and it works out.
Yeah, but, I mean, they'll also be stepping stones, so, yes, so, okay.
Speaking of which...
Speaking of which, hello, welcome to the Hope This Helps podcast. I am Steve.
I am Tiff.
Question mark.
I am Ron Burgundy.
I'm Ron Burgundy, question mark.
I love scotch.
Yes, scotch. We take 3 minutes and 19 seconds to actually get going before the podcast begins.
You should see me in the morning when I get up for work. It takes 2 hours.
It's like how my commute, since working from home, my commute has been cut in half. It now takes me 15 minutes to get to work.
Yes, 15 minutes to get to work.
It also takes me 9+ hours to speak correctly, apparently. So before COVID, my commute took 30 minutes, you know, to drive and, you know, get dressed and everything. Now it's 15 to get up, to snooze my alarm again. Open Teams on an iPad, open my email on an iPad, and see if things are actually urgent or on fire. Then you get up, and I'm old now. I need to stretch and stretch and
stretch more.
Brush my teeth.
Several
check
times.
Check my calendar. When's my first meeting again?
It's not
till like 9.
I underappreciate the office for the fact that I don't remember when I have meetings anymore.
I've been late to some meetings for the first time in like my professional career, like ever. And it's mostly because like somehow in the office, I either can just have more of a sense of awareness around me, or I can just sense when people are moving to a conference room or when a meeting's about to start. When I'm working from home, sometimes I just get in the zone when I'm actually working on something else. And I'll snooze that Outlook notification, you know, 15 minutes before start. And I always click snooze it till 5 minutes before start. But I also click snooze until 0 minutes before start. And sometimes I then miss the notification again. And hey, all of a sudden I'm like, hey, wasn't there supposed to be a oh, no. And I look at the notification and it said about 20 minutes overdue. Jump into the meeting. I'm like, hey, guys, there was a car crash on the way to my computer.
I got stuck in traffic.
Yeah, you won't believe the pile up on the interstate staircase in my house right now.
Right. But, oh, no, I just saw someone get stabbed.
Yeah, my pool caught fire. There were rabbits outside.
The birds prevented me from entering the building.
It was unreal. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, after the first two or three or four times, it gets a little tough to come up with new excuses as to why it was so hard to click that button to join a meeting. It's pain points of working from home that I'm not very good at. Anyways, so I digress. This has been just me failing at life podcast.
This is because we clearly fail at life daily, and we're trying to cover that up.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, shall we? Big packages. I feel like this is like a follow-up from the dongle question.
We're just, yeah.
Big packages and dongles?
In the Phallic Tech References Showcase, I think we will call this. We are talking about the big package manager that Microsoft announced. At Build.
Oh, good. Goody.
The MPMP. The Windows... Sorry, the WPMP.
that's a mouthful.
The WPMP. The Windows Package Manager Preview.
Wait, they even called the W... They even gave the acronym WPMP. Do you think someone was onto that? Like,
I don't know if that's officially the acronym. No, but that's just taking good. The first letter.
That is good, though. We could start something.
Yeah, so the WPMP, or the Windows Package Manager Preview, and with its less exciting name known as WinGet for the client, is the Windows Package Manager Preview, which is effectively, this is really awesome. This is Microsoft trying to get closer to the Linux world of apt-get install or yum install or whatever your package manager of choice is. There's also Pac-Man in Linux. There's all kinds of different ones, but Microsoft's finally making their own, and this is going to be really cool in the future for deployment, particularly of applications. I believe VS Code might be one of the first beta-E programs that will be offered through this, and in a perfect world, this will be all command line-based installations of applications, or if you just need something, you just say WinGet install VS Code or whatever. So this is going to be very big. This is a very big first step for Microsoft. It's currently only available in the, the insider preview of Windows 10. So it's not currently in production Windows 10. You have to install an insider build. So take that as you will, depending on how brave you are. But this is coming down the pipeline, and this is going to be amazing.
You are so excited about this. I don't think I've heard you excited about anything.
This is more exciting for me because I've been using Linux more lately, and it's nice when you just need something, you can just say sudo apt-get install, blah, 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 and it's usually right. Just there.
What's also really cool is that it looks like you can do it without UAC pop-ups.
Right. I assume that you'd have to run the command line like PowerShell as an administrator for this to work. As far as I know, Microsoft doesn't have a sudo equivalent, so in Linux, when you run sudo, you get a quote-unquote UAC prompt in the terminal window where you have to enter your sudo password. Microsoft achieves this with UAC, but in terms of the terminal, I think you have to run it as an administrator to achieve the same goal currently, or you have to install some custom PowerShell module that someone wrote, which will elevate using some deeper level API calls in the Windows OS or whatever. But I think that maybe that's coming someday, and maybe it's, I don't think it's actually in this release, but
no.
But hey, it's still better than what it was before. It's nice to see more Linux-y things come to Windows and
yay.
More conventional installation methods that are universal and more automatable.
Convention. I feel like that's almost like, no, I don't know. I was trying to think, make like a Schoolhouse Rock reference, but I've got nothing.
Convention.
Here's your detention.
Here's your detention.
There we go.
I mean, conventions also don't really happen anymore. Build no, is online.
No, they're online. But speaking of learning and attention...
Let's talk about failing out.
Let's talk about El Studiantes.
Yeah, so in other non-Microsoft news, there the College Board. Remember the College Board?
Yes, that was so long ago.
Like that really kind of... I thought it was really annoying busy work that they where you had to do all the stuff to supposedly prepare for college and write all these essays and a bunch of stuff. In hindsight, I don't know if it ever actually did anything for me college wise, but anyways, so they have AP tests on their site as one of their offered services, and as part of these AP tests you need to submit a photo of the answers. And with recent iPhones, starting with the iPhone 7 and higher, I believe, they moved to a new compressed image and video format called HEIC. And the College Board does not recognize this file format, which, guess what, most smartphone users in the US at least, and, well, maybe not so much the world, but they take photos with this format, which Apple switched over to. And unless you convert it to JPEG, which it probably won't by default, so unless you have to go into the settings menu of the iPhone and switch over that setting explicitly, most folks aren't going to do that. So they will upload their photo of their answer key, and the College Board didn't recognize it, and it failed them. And this became apparently an epidemic where most people are just failing out of their AP tests because it didn't recognize the HEIC format.
Wait, I feel like every website ever... support the iPhone photo upload.
It would support it. Yeah, you would imagine it would support it at the very least with the JPEG conversion, but I guess this just literally took it at face value and saw an HEIC file and thought, what is this? This isn't a JPEG or a PNG or whatever. It just literally looked at the file extension and just threw it out. So that was interesting. On one hand, I kind of understand, because this is a file format that Apple kind of just invented one day, which, I mean, it does make sense for the way they're using it, and it is convertible to JPEG if you just use the right settings and if websites support that. But if you're just taking the raw file and you don't know what it is, that becomes a problem. Windows 10 in particular didn't natively support HEIC until... maybe a couple of revisions ago. For a while, you had to install an extension out of the Windows Store. Now I believe it's just built in. But regardless, it's not a guarantee. It's not a guaranteed given that this file format is going to be supported always, including the College Board. But hopefully now they will think about that.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. So...
this is absolutely unacceptable. I love how that's a quote in this article.
Oh, yeah. Then you have the people just panicking or freaking out, and then it's the usual hysterics. But, I mean, can you blame them, to be honest? If this was the thing that failed you into a college entrance exam, I mean, I'd be kind of mad, too. But, you know, it is what it is, I guess.
Well, especially because this is stupid.
Right.
What do these tests even prove?
That you're very smart with
testing?
Things and testing, which I'm never good at.
Not to be like that person, but most people that I've known that have taken AP classes were just good at reading and taking tests.
Right.
You're either a
smart person or you're a good test taker, and often they don't cross.
Often they're not the ones in the AP classes. I feel like most of the smart people I know are like very lazy people. I'm not stereotyping, but I am.
Mm-hmm. I am also very lazy.
I know you are, and you're very smart.
I have two or three Azure exam vouchers that I've been just putting off and off and off, and I need to take them soon because they're expiring at some point.
June.
And yeah, although I was told apparently Microsoft extended them to 2021 due to COVID, so I can procrastinate just a little bit longer. So, but I would rather take them now because I just finished my third Azure training, and while this is all fresh in my mind and before it all falls out of my head, I probably should get the certification to say, hey, at that particular point in time, I knew something about Azure.
Agreed. I think you would likely pass right now.
Hopefully. I'm going to take 900 first, which is the easier one. That's the fundamentals one, which Microsoft has also seemed to be keen on having everyone and their mother take the training on, because they're giving out free vouchers all the time now, it seems.
Oh, that is pretty good to know.
I think they just issued another round of training for that particular series.
Oh, really?
I think I saw a thread on the sysadmin subreddit about that.
I think that they are really trying to compete with AWS real bad.
Yes, they want them. They're really ramping that up. And I mean, all power to them. They just want all kinds of all the hosting monies and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just really want to blow AWS out of the water.
Sweet, sweet hosting cash money dollars. And both of those services are really expensive.
Azure is surprisingly expensive. Mm-hmm. Even when I was using my Azure Pass subscription, I was amazed at how I was actually burning through cash just like running VMs and leaving them on. Even in the training, they were like, hey, this is a 3-day training. Make sure you power your VMs off in between sessions, because instead of a lab environment with accounts that belong to the trainer company, they actually had us use our own accounts for Azure, which really made me nervous, where it was like, okay, here's your Azure Pass, whatever amount of money subscription, I forget how much. And it also was time limited, I think. But it was like, if you screwed it up on the first day during the first labs and you spun up too many VMs and you ran them running overnight, you had a potential to run your subscription out and then you'd be screwed for future labs in the class.
That is annoying.
It's annoying, but at the same time, it does kind of help in a way, because mm-hmm. then it kind of makes you more aware of how much money you are burning, and it gives in instead of there is something to be said about if you have unlimited resources, you don't think about those resources, and when you suddenly have to manage and, you know, keep track of all of this, then that kind of lights a fire under you to say, hey, I need to make sure I'm powering these VMs off at night. I need to run the Azure Cost Analysis Center and look at the recommendations and just factor all that in.
I feel like you would need to hire a person just to do that.
You could. That's the money making scheme.
It's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work.
It is a lot of work, especially if you have a lot of VMs and.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And that's what Azure. That's where they get you, because Azure wants you to put a lot of VMs in the cloud or containers or whatever.
Whatever they're calling them these days.
Traffic managers, VPN. It's all measured. It's all billable monthly.
Yeah. And then
or as you go.
You'll just go broke. So we're going to party like it's 2004, I think.
Yes, 2004. Or 2005? Or
yeah.
2003?
2000 and whatever.
Yeah, Windows 10 2004 is coming out. Or is out. Slowly rolling out. And it's breaking everybody's computers, it seems. So 2004 or 2004 or 2020 April, which is the fourth month of the year, is the latest feature update or FU of Windows 10. And it's out now. It's being slowly and carefully trickled out because Microsoft is a little gun shy based on two FUs ago where it kind of had a lot of problems. So I guess to prevent massive breakage in an era where people are working from home, it's making its way out only if you explicitly go out and seek it by clicking searching for updates with Microsoft Update.
Oh.
There's been some reports here and there where it's not going so well. There's been some driver issues, Bluetooth issues, NVIDIA issues, systems not booting, some of the usual suspects. And anecdotally, I've seen more of these reports than I think what I saw with 1909. So it's a little, I'd say proceed with caution or do what I do and just wait 6 months before you install the latest feature update, which I think is a winning strategy because it seems the first version is always a little rickety. So don't be a beta tester. Don't be the one.
Don't be a hero.
Don't be a hero.
Don't be a hero. Nobody cares.
Yeah, don't party like it's 2004. Party like it's 1909 instead.
1909. I'll get my petticoat ready.
Yeah, it might be a good idea if it's still available to go to the download Windows 10 page and grab yourself an ISO of 1909 before it gets replaced with the 2004 ISO, which is really funny because it's May and we're getting a Windows version that was tagged for April 2020, which in itself was supposed to originally come out in March, which would have given it 2003. And that would have been a whole can of worms in itself to have a version called Windows 2003 when we had Server 2003.
Mm.
That was one of the reasons they delayed it a month, but then it was late anyway.
Well, typical Microsoft fashion.
Yeah, I think they really painted themselves into a corner with this version number scheme.
Yeah. At least for now. 1703, though, just don't do it. Or 1803. Just don't do the 03s.
I remember 1703 was bad. 1803, I think, also was bad. 1809
was okay.
Yeah, I forget which one was really, really bad, but yeah,
I think it was 1703. I think
something in 17 was bad, and I think a 19 was bad. I think it was 1903, I think, was the one that was wiping people's profiles out, if I remember.
Oh.
Yeah, citation needed on that, but I think that might have been the one, so.
Did I make a note?
Mm-hmm. I'm losing track of all the Windows 10 versions, because there's been a lot of them since 1507, I think, was the very first one, 2015. So, anyway, all right, I guess we're enough on ragging on Windows 10. So, what's going on with Teams?
Oh, yeah, so Teams. So, during Build last week, they announced a lot of really cool stuff. I will get into that probably next week, just because I just am in still Smoky Mountains brain. And there's a lot of stuff that's coming out. But also, I remember reading an article somewhere where Microsoft said they were going to start switching tenants over, which now I cannot find this documentation anywhere, that they would begin moving or migrating tenants over to Teams-only mode. And recently, I started seeing tenants moving over to Teams-only mode, which is great and all. But if you're not ready, it's quite a surprise.
Yeah. All your meetings.
All your meetings and everything's just like, now I'm stuck in this mode. On top of that, this is not really Teams related, but in case anybody's aware, Microsoft has also been announcing since December that they are deprecating Microsoft Video. And if you are really unaware of what that is, Streams has replaced it. And video was just kind of one of those functionalities I don't think anyone really paid attention to, that was sort of just like baked into the Office 365, Microsoft 365 suite. And they're deprecating it. However, if you didn't get the notification to delay the migration of from video to Streams, they're in phase two right now and they are migrating tenants over. So if you happen to be one of those tenants that you're going to need to license all of your users with video, you didn't have to. And Streams is part of the E3 license, so you don't have to panic about paying for an additional license. So just keep up with the changes that are coming, because they are happening more and more frequently, and the carpet can totally be pulled from underneath you if you're not paying attention.
Microsoft Video, I don't think I've ever heard of that.
No, I didn't either. But apparently if you record videos like in SharePoint and so forth, it was one of the ones that was constantly, it was the main one. But there's also like the Azure Video Service or something like that, which is a different service, but not really like well known. It's so confusing.
Yeah, that's really strange. Yeah, I haven't heard of Microsoft Video. Maybe it was just one of those like underlying technologies that just kind of existed in the background and wasn't really a super duper thing. I don't know.
Yeah, but I don't think it had like good codec or anything like that.
Yeah, when I think something is called as basic as Microsoft Video, I think of like maybe like a built-in video file on like the Windows ME CD-ROM file or something. You know, something really, really old and crusty that, if it has that basic good name, it probably deserved to die at some point.
Right. It's almost like Windows Media Player, I would say. Like, why is that even still a thing?
Long live the WMV format.
Oh, like, I remember, like, growing up, and whenever somebody opened something in Windows Media Player, I think I still twitch to this day.
I really, yeah, because with Windows Media Player, it was like, whenever you launched it, half the time it wasn't even configured, so you'd have to go through the setup wizard. And once you even got into it and you were trying to load a video file, it was maybe a 50-50 chance that the video file would even work in Windows Media Player.
Agreed.
Because it was really picky as to what files it liked to play, especially back in the day, you know, in the XP days. It got better years later, but now we all just use VLC like you know, sensible human beings.
Right, right. The normal people.
Cool. All right. So, so Teams only mode with tenants. So is that going to just completely shut off Skype for Business? Is that the same as Islands mode?
So Teams only mode is not Islands mode.
Well, I guess I have issues understanding that. So what is like Islands mode versus Teams only mode?
So Islands mode is one of the interop modes that allows you to run both Skype for Business and Teams together simultaneously. So once you switch to Teams only modes, you can no longer use Skype for Business. So like,
it
like takes away the functionality. So you can still join Skype meetings through it, but you can't like chat or create meetings in it anymore. So really it's just like a platform for people who are still on Skype.
I think I suddenly get it now. Yeah, Islands mode is like you have two islands. One is the Isle of Skype, the other is the Isle of Teams. And in Teams only mode, we blew up the island of Skype and you only have the Isle of Teams.
Correct. So in the Isle, so when you have both islands, Teams and Skype together, if you are a Teams only person, you cannot, you can talk to Skype people, but it gives them a notification saying, hey, this person's trying to, it's almost like a collect call. Like, hey, do you want to accept the message from so-and-so? By doing so, press here, and then the Skype person can then message the Teams person and then open that pathway.
I see. Okay, so yeah, Islands mode is sort of, yeah, the coexistence mode.
Yeah, they just kind of like operate independently, but if you want to call them, you need, they're not like the same country. You need like a collect card and a country code.
I see. Okay, all right, now that suddenly makes a whole lot more sense to me, so.
Yeah. It does. Awesome. It's a little bit confusing, especially when you start introducing like the backdoors, such as Skype users can message Teams users, but Teams users can kind of message Skype users.
And there's also the question of can Teams message Skype consumer users too, just like how Skype for Business could.
Not yet.
Yeah, I hear it's going to eventually be a feature. Mm-hmm. Because it was a feature in Skype for Business, which is kind of funny when you think about it, because you're like, oh yeah, Skype Consumer exists still. It hasn't, you know, because Microsoft owns it. Back in the day, they wanted to promote it before Teams was a thing, so they renamed Link to be Skype for Business, and they're like, yeah, Skype, and then now it's 2020, and we have Zoom and all these other fun technologies. Microsoft made Teams and now they're getting rid of Skype for Business. And it's like, oh yeah, consumer Skype exists, but there was this link between it and Skype for Business. And they're like, oh, do we have to drag that into Teams now?
Yeah, no, it is. And they are adding those things. And it just is taking time. And since like the whole COVID thing, they're definitely adding things faster, but they're doing more of the user focused stuff first. So it is coming.
Yeah. Yeah. And that makes total sense. It'd probably just be an eventually or based on utilization or usage statistics. Demand-based feature.
So I can't help every time I read Steve does PowerShell, I think Debbie does Dallas.
Yep, I kept the name, and that was precisely.
I love it. I feel like I mentioned that before, but every single time.
It's the callback to Debbie does Dallas, Steve does PowerShell. We're just going to keep on chugging along with that name for whatever it's worth.
For a very long time.
Yeah. So let's do some PowerShell. So
let's do it.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about a couple of random things, particularly one of my favorite ways to view data, which is outgrid view, clip, some regular expression funness in VS Code that can help you with PowerShell data and manipulating large lists to get them into arrays. And all kinds of things. So some of these are unrelated. I kind of just felt like lumping these together because some of these weren't, I didn't quite have enough content to really give it its own topic. So outgrid view is, of course, a really cool way to display data that is returned in tables or objects that are sortable or things that can be formatted as a table or list. What this basically does is it brings up an interactive separate window in the PowerShell environment that lets you interactively sort, filter, copy, all kinds, and sort, filter, copy, all kinds of fun stuff with the data that you receive. And it's really nice because you would want to use this over a situation like export CSV. If you're returning a lot of data, say you're doing get a user filter or blah, 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 and you know it's going to return like maybe 200 or so users, but you don't particularly care about this data enough where you want to export a CSV and then go and hunt and peck for that CSV in some temp directory that you saved it to, AdGridView just opens it up in this single view that is, you know, close enough to Excel's filtered views. You can look at the data, you can search it, and if you need to revise your query to get different data than you were expecting, it's just a nice way to do trial and error faster and just get the results you want more efficiently. And personally, if I need to view something where I need to sort and I don't want to fiddle around with options like sort object or select object or where clauses, where I just don't have the mental bandwidth to have to keep writing these queries and clauses over and over, AdGridView is kind of the solution for that. It's one of those things where you don't want to get stuck on the little details like the syntax, and you're just like, I know what I want to view and I know how to do it, just briefly give me a little interface where I can just get the data I want and then get out. And that's one of the miracles of AdGridView. It is in PowerShell core, which is PowerShell 7, PowerShell 6, whatever. It is cross-platform now as part of a separate and new module that you have to install separately. As far as I know, I think you still have to install it separately, but I think they are working on baking it into the full product for Linux and Mac, and it functions all in the same exact manner over on those platforms as well. And coming soon will be OutConsoleGridView, which is a similar concept, but instead of a separate window, it will be inside the same PowerShell window, and it'll be the same kind of idea, except it'll just be one less window. But so that's AdGridView. Another one of my favorite little mini features of PowerShell is called Clip, where if you have compatible output data in PowerShell and you want to get into your clipboard really quickly, just do a pipe clip at the end of your command. So if I want to get 80 user John Doe, I could say get 80 user John Doe, select SAM account name, pipe clip. And if you check your Windows clipboard with your Windows V, you'll notice that that data that was returned is now in your clipboard and ready to copy somewhere. And this is not just limited to a single line value. This can work for entire arrays or large tables of data. Anything you want to copy into Excel or into a message or anywhere you see fit, into VS Code perhaps. It's just a really nice way to just get it out of the PowerShell window and into something else. So like OutGridView, it's a great little utility that just gets things done faster without having to think about it so much or worrying about if copying in the PowerShell console window is going to go hokey on you, or if you have to remember if you have to right click or press enter, depending on which flavor or version of the terminal window that you are using, whether it's the Unix based right click or the Windows based press enter to copy kind of deal. But that is the situation with Clip, and it is a wonderful little thing, and it's so subtle that I think a lot of people just kind of gloss over it, but it's really, really nice. And lastly, there's some cool little things in Visual Studio Code where there is a regex find and replace in VS Code. So what this enables you to do, particularly with PowerShell, is it can let you manipulate some data and get it into definitions for things like arrays or comma separated values, and it just does it really quickly. Some of my favorite ones, which I will post in the show notes because trying to say these is like vomiting characters and letters and words, is there's regex for things like blank lines, finding email addresses, integers. You can find things like MAC addresses, starts of lines, ends of lines, certain sequences of characters. It's whatever, you know, if you're familiar with regex, you know how, you know where I'm going with this. So it lets you do particular finds and replaces. But one of the most MVP regex finds and replaces that I do daily, particularly because I work with a lot of email addresses, is say you have a big list of email addresses separated by line breaks, maybe a couple of blank line breaks in between. You can do a regex find for blank lines. You can replace that with nothing. And then you do find the end of a line for each one. and you replace it with a caret whack n, and you enclose it in double quotes and a comma at the end. And if you add that to the end of each line, and then you enclose the very beginning of the first line with a array definition and end the final line with the closure of an array, you can assign this whole pile of data to a single array variable, and then you can use it for whatever. You can say for each, you can clip it if you display it, or whatever you see fit. But this is a really, really fun and easy way of just manipulating a lot of data really quickly and just getting, you know, just being more efficient using VS Code and PowerShell.
That sounds really cool. I didn't know that you could do the VS Code with regex. That's pretty helpful.
Yep. So the regex button, when you do Control F, it's the third option in VS Code. It's like a little like asterisk. It's like a dot asterisk. It's after the two case match buttons. But when you just tick that off, it'll switch the find and replace into regex mode. You just have to remember you have to toggle it off if you want to go back into regular find and replace mode, because if you leave it on, you might get some strange or unexpected results.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I must say, I'm going to have to try that one.
Yeah, I will post in the show notes some of my favorite and most used regex things that I use in VS Code for finding and replacing, and some examples for how to manipulate large data really easily. But it really makes life a whole lot easier.
I'm pretty excited about that now.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to give it a shot.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Okay, so what else do we got? So Power Toys is a thing. I don't know if you've used it a lot, Tiff, but I've been kind of watching it. And
I've been watching it, but I haven't used it.
So it kind of started with a, oh, that's cool. That's something I might use once and maybe never touch again. But it's actually really evolved into something kind of amazing now. So Power Toys is a revival of a set of utilities for power users that Microsoft used to maintain back in the Windows 95 and Windows XP days, but it's now come back in the Windows 10 era in kind of a new reborn, modernized fashion. It's open source as well. It is hosted on GitHub. Each module is contained in its own repository, as well as the super repository known as Power Toys. And in particular, there are three really nice tools that I think that I want to highlight here that are really good. So the first one's called Power Rename. So this is sort of a GUI edition of a file renamer that is really nice, in particular if you need to rename a bunch of files to a certain convention. In particular, you can do regex, you can do character matching, you can make files uniform. It's really nice if you want to like label MP3s, or you want to make something really consistent with like dashes in between to denote delimiters or whatever. But Power Rename is really, really awesome. The interface is really simple and straightforward, and it's just awesome. I don't know how else to explain it, but Power Rename is a fantastic addition. That's kind of the first toe you dip into Power Toys.
That's so, yes, that's where you can do like the batch renaming of files and stuff.
Yep, exactly. That's the one.
So cool.
Yeah. And another one, this one is also incredibly simple. It's the Windows Key Shortcut Guide. So a lot of people know that there are random Windows exclusive shortcuts in the Microsoft Windows world, but unless you're like searching this all day, or you have some reference that you wrote down yourself, it's hard to remember what a lot of these are. And in particular, with Windows 8 and Windows 10, they added a whole lot more new shortcuts that do more of exclusive or touch-friendly actions to in these newer operating systems. And with the Windows Key Shortcut Guide, if you hold down the Windows key for about a second and a half, it will pull up a cheat sheet just telling you, hey, these are what all the shortcut keys are for the Windows key, and this is what they do. And it's just a nice little quick reference without having to Google it or anything else. For example, it's like, did you know that Windows G opens the game bar? I did not. I won't ever know that, but it's nice that this little cheat sheet just shows me that.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I didn't know that either.
Or if you use dictation, Windows H will open the dictation bar.
Yay! So many cool things.
Yeah, and it tells you all of these in this nice little cheat sheet. It'll also tell you the shortcut keys for your taskbar. So if you hit, like, for example, Windows 1, it'll activate the first item in your taskbar in Windows. For example, my first item is File Explorer. So if I hit Windows 1, I would launch File Explorer. Or if I hit Windows 2, I'd launch Firefox. Or Windows 3, everything search. And yada, yada, yada. And it just highlights that on the first 10 items. So I think it only goes up to the first 10 because there's only 10 number keys going across the way. But it's just a nice little feature, just kind of highlight an existing but powerful shortcut key combination set. There's a third one, right? Yep, there's a third one. So the third one is PowerToys Run. This is sort of Microsoft's attempt to steal the spotlight from Apple, quite literally. So with this new utility, which has gone through a couple of UI iterations and I think possibly a name change, this was originally a search running processes search bar, and it's turned into a full UI search feature akin to the Windows 10 start menu search or macOS's Spotlight. And the UI very much borrows inspiration from that world. It is activated via Alt space in the current iteration, and it appears to really only be limited to documents that are on your local drives. Doesn't appear to search for network locations just yet unless you have shortcut locations, but it is really awesome. It's not quite everything search levels of good. It's still under active development, and I think it is marked as preview, but I have a feeling this was originally a contender for a search feature to be baked into the OS, and it might just not have been ready for prime time, so they made it a power toy instead.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So it's like Spotlight almost?
Yep, imagine a Spotlight search on macOS. It's literally just that. I think it's actually a little bit better than the start menu search, funny enough, because it does not do Bing searches. It doesn't reach the internet. It just does your local computer search, which has been a major complaint of Windows 8 and Windows 10.
That is amazing. I just want it to just search my computer. That is it.
That sounds very much the Microsoft way, where it's like, are users complaining about a major feature not performing up to standards? Well, let's not improve it. Let's just make another nearly equivalent feature, but keep both of them in the OS.
And let's make a power toy. Parties.
Yeah, let's make it a power toy, because it sounds scary to regular normie users. So those are my three. Yeah, those are my three power toys Spotlight items thus far. They're still under active development. The updates are coming fast and furious. In fact, mine's prompting me for an update right now. So they're very, very much under, some are under preview and some are being added probably right up to the minute. So it's over on GitHub, the Microsoft Power Toys GitHub page. Check it out. It's a whole lot of fun.
Yay, Power Toys. So we've already been doing this for like 58 minutes already. This is insane.
Yeah.
So ransomware protection. What is this all about?
So ransomware protection. There are two primary ways. If you're in the Windows world and you want to save yourself from ransomware attacks, or at least prevent some nasty occurrences from happening. So if you're running just Windows 10, pretty much any version from 1709 and up, you have a lot of ransomware protection already available to you. And it is called controlled folder access. It might also be known as ransomware protection in the settings menu. And for Windows 10 client-side protection, controlled folder access is basically really, really good. The only side effect of it is it can be really annoying at first. You have to whitelist a whole lot of executables, including even official operating system level executables, before it really gets comfortable. But once you have that whitelist in place, it's really, really nice, because if you just accidentally download the wrong executable, or you get fooled by clicking a wrong erroneous download link and you run something you weren't supposed to, you could be in for a world of hurt, even if this program doesn't have local administrator access, but it has access to things like your documents folder, your desktop folder, you have mapped network drives somewhere. What controlled folder access can prevent is it actively scans for file changes to these folders, and if it sees the executable not in its whitelist and it notices that it's trying to make these changes, it goes, no, you're not allowed to make these changes. We've blocked this and we've logged this. You can add this to the whitelist if you want this to happen, but otherwise do not pass go, do not collect $200. And It's something also, if you have Windows Defender ATP, the logs will get sucked up into that, and there is additional functionality in Microsoft 365 Defender ATP. Not only that, it also has GPIO controls. So under configuration, administrative templates, Windows components, Windows Defender antivirus, Windows Defender exploit guard, controlled folder access, you can control this setting via GPIO, and you can enable it for endpoints in your enterprise if you see fit. There's also PowerShell commands to enable this locally. You don't have to be on a domain if you want to just enable this and manage this with PowerShell. If you, in particularly, run the command set MP preference enable controlled folder access enabled, this will enable it in PowerShell right out of the box. And you can also add executables to the whitelist via PowerShell as well. And if you're really, and using just standard PowerShell logic like for each or reading out of a text file or CSV, you can import a list of executables that you want to mark as good and safe. And that will ease the pain of the initial over-protectiveness of the feature. And that makes it really, really versatile. So say you have another computer that's had this feature on for a while and you have a good whitelist, you can export that whitelist out of that machine and you can import it onto another machine, which means the new machine being onboarded is not, you know, really dead in the water with having to rebuild that list. It's just, it's got the list from the other machine. Most executables are usually in the same place on file paths, and you can just have it hit the ground running. So that's a rather, it's not talked about much, and this feature is really awesome. I have it running on my personal machines, and I feel safer with it. The only problem I have with it is if you happen to be running a program that does try to save a file or manipulate a file in any way and it gets blocked, you have to actually close the program out and relaunch it. You have to close the program out, add it to the whitelist, and then relaunch it in order for the whitelisting to take effect. It isn't I wish they would kind of clean that up just a little bit or allow you to go back to past blocked events and allow them and have it complete. But other than that, once you kind of understand how it behaves and how you can't exactly, you know, you can allow an action, but it won't exactly cause the action to complete. So as long as you can get over that, it's a nice feature. And you will feel safer if you particularly deal with programs that really modify things they shouldn't.
You just like went on like a little.
I just went there for a little bit. So that was controlled folder access. That's more the new and flashy version of ransomware protection that's client side. If you host files on a file server, there is an older technology called File System Resource Manager.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, and this is the more classical way to prevent ransomware. It doesn't prevent it on the client side, it prevents it on the server side. So this is assuming that you still have an on-premises file server and everyone is saving there. And if some schmuck decides to download an executable and they run it and they hose their machine and they hose, you know, and it tries to reach out to network drives, which is what a lot of these ransomware variants do, FSRM will kick in if it has a blacklist configured, and it will stop the file IO operation from completing. And there are folks that have written scripts that built in all these, you know, these common ransomware file types, and is updated regularly through a GitHub. And you can just run their code, their PowerShell commands to just install FSRM and configure it. So right out of the box, you are protected. So this is a little bit of an older technology. It does not stop client-side ransomware infections from infecting local files, but it is there and can give some peace of mind if you have a lot of folks in an enterprise on-premise file server that you want to protect. So that is controlled folder access and FSRM, and we'll have some links in the show notes to some of the gritty, nitty-gritty details and where to find that GitHub script for FSRM in particular.
I'm pretty excited to try that out. It looks really awesome.
Yeah, I would recommend trying it out in a lab environment or in a test environment for sure first, because it is possible for things, you know, if you get it wrong, it could cause a work stoppage or cause someone's file to not be saved. So you do kind of want to make sure you know what you're doing with it, or at least expect, you know how to handle the all the quirkiness that it may offer if it's not gonna perform the way you expect it to.
That's a good point.
Okay, so
moving along. That's really cool, MSA.
Yeah. All the ransomware stuff, because that despite it being several years into the ransomware era, it's just not going away at this point. It's become an effective way of criminal enterprise, so you need to know how to prepare for it and prevent.
Right. Stay safe.
Stay safe and apply PPE.
Yeah. All that stuff. Whatever they taught you it's in sex ed. Anyways. So we are just about done. Honestly, I'm surprised that we were able to stretch out our very limited content this week.
We're good at BSing our way to a full hour's worth of content, I guess.
I guess we just say a lot of things that don't really make sense and provide you a lot of filler. So this week, let's just have our question of the week. What do you think are rejected Azure product ideas? So I can just imagine a bunch of Microsoft people sitting in a room and people just saying words.
Yeah, so it's no secret that Microsoft always introduces a lot of products in preview. And as every Microsoft MVP says, do not enable a preview product in production when it comes to Azure or a cloud-based product, because there is no guarantee whatsoever that this product will actually stay around. It could get removed. It could get drastically changed. It could, you know, so don't enable it for production, especially because that may introduce unexpected change. So that's why it's always tagged as preview. And as a result, I kind of sat and thought, so what kind of stuff do you think Microsoft did for Azure that never even made the cut to be added as a preview feature? What was a rejected product idea for Azure preview? And I kind of sat around and thought about it for a while, and I thought, what kind of ridiculous things could Azure AI do? So I don't know, how about Azure scoreboard? Think of every scoreboard you've ever seen in like a soccer or baseball or hockey game, and imagine it just being powered by Azure, like whole entire Azure resource manager groups and VMs and containers, Kubernetes clusters, all that. Imagine just Azure scoreboard preview. And Apple, imagine turning that on in your tenant.
Yeah, no, honestly, I think that you and I would use that a real lot.
Yeah.
For all of the things we've done, like the Hasselhoff days.
Azure Hasselhoff.
Azure Hoff.
Like anytime someone didn't lock their computer and they got Hasselhoffed, like there was just a whole dashboard of statistics and metrics in Azure.
It would just keep it in scoreboard too. It would be amazing.
It would report it to the Azure scoreboard, which would be showing up on your C-level's TVs for their, you know, their daily Scrum dashboards. You know, just explaining who got hoffed and how often they get hoffed and what is the percentage of expectation that they will get hoffed in the future.
Hold on. I really like this one that you came up with. Azure ARM template for Hannah Montana Linux.
Yes, so... So as we know, Azure supports many, many, many flavors of Linux. One of the most infamous versions of Linux that came out maybe about 11 or 12 years ago was the Hannah Montana Linux, which was an Ubuntu distribution with a Hannah Montana skin very thoroughly applied to it. It has never really been updated ever since, but I think that someone at Microsoft at some point was thinking, what if we put a JSON or ARM template for deploying a Hannah Montana Linux VM in Azure? I think that was thought of at some point. Someone thought of it.
It's pretty genius, honestly. Mm-hmm. I must say.
Another one I thought of in my sleep. I was like, what if there was just a physical Azure robot? You know, it had a 5G antenna in it, and it was just walking all of the beaches of the world, and it was just counting. And it was counting every single grain of sand in the world.
That's so good and so awful at the same time. It would just be like the bored robot. It would be like, I'm just bored.
The Azure Beach Sand Counter AI. And I can just imagine that. Just walking like the beaches of, I don't know, Cancun. And I don't know, a little kid walks up to it and goes, like, who are you? What are you doing? Goes, I am counting sand. He goes,
this is fun.
Do not disrupt the Azure Sand AI.
Now I must recount every particle of sand.
Because data is powerful in this age, so what would you think that sand counting would do for you in this modern AI cloud era? I don't know where else I was going with that.
I don't either. Anyways, welcome to the Hope This Helps podcast.
We come up with stupid ideas. We say stuff, we do stuff.
And we really hope this helps.
We hope it helps. This is a podcast. We've recorded 16 other of these podcasts up to this point.
This is amazing. I was just thinking about this while we were recording. We've been recording for almost 6 months. This is the most consistent thing I've done in my life.
That is unbelievable.
Besides wake up.
Waking up is very consistent, that is. We hope to make this podcast as consistent as waking up, if we possibly can.
And just like waking up, it sucks every time you do it.
Yeah, it doesn't make it any less awful every morning to have to wake up and actually get yourself moving and stretching and everything, like commuting to work or whatever, but we carry on, we move ahead. So we are the Hope This Helps podcast. Rate us on iTunes, check us out everywheres. We have a website, hghpc.com.
Someday we will get to adding more content to it. We keep saying that, but I get that life is busy, and I think COVID has us all a little bit somewhat pretend depressed.
A little bit.
We're not as functional as we would have been. And to those people who are functional, being in quarantine, congrats, because that is not me.
Mm-hmm. Congrats.
Congrats.
Thank you very much.
HHPC.com. Check us out. Our podcast is there. Steve has been doing a great job. We realized today we're worth 50 cents.
We are worth 50 cents, apparently.
So
I don't know how they got to that conclusion, but it sounds right to me.
Anyways, hope this helps. We're going to probably go now because it sounds like we're sleeping.
Yeah, I think we're tapped out for the night. So from everyone here, we hope this helps.